Call us to order. We are at 11:02. So this is a joint meeting of the Boone County Commission and the Columbia City Council. It's our second meeting about the housing assessment that we received. Appreciate everybody coming over. Last time we went to the county, appreciate you guys coming to our house. We have more room. from our room, we were kind of filling that one up. So we have a few things on our agenda. Attached to the agenda of today, you obviously saw the report that came from staff to Columbia City Council, and then also the recommendations and the implementation summary. So I think with that, I'm going to kick it off to Carly. Am I kicking it to Becky and Joanne?
Or, yes.
Okay, I'm kicking it to Becky and Joanne. So thank you all.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming here. This has been a long, hard battle that's not over. My name is Joanne Nelson, and I am the director of the Boone County Community Services Department. And I just thought I'd give a brief history for those who don't know, I'm sure all of you do, but our department had received some funding from the Urban Institute to develop a mobility action plan, an upward mobility action plan, and out of that came three work groups. We had the Fair Inclusive Housing, the Jobs and Workforce, and Early Grade Literacy. And with the Fair and Inclusive Housing, one of the strategic actions was to develop a housing study. And we knew the city had done one years ago. I don't believe a county ever did one, so we felt like a really good move would be to have a joint housing study. So we met with city, the time was right, we had some ARPA funds, we were able to put this into play. The Community Services Department oversaw it with the help of city and county leadership and department level folks. And we hired Dr. David Boston to do the comprehensive housing study. Those are uploaded to the Community Services website, and I believe it's on your website as well if anybody needs to see that. But today we felt like we had a pre-meeting before our housing summit that we have. We had a great attendance at a housing study. I mean, we had 181 people in and out all day long, and we really got some great information, some great feedback from the community. And so now we're taking this, and now we're actually going to do the hard work that we have to do both at the city and the county level. And so I'll turn it over to Becky now. I don't know if we want to do introductions or anything like that.
Yeah, I think starting with introductions would be great. I'll start with myself. I'm Becky Thompson, and I'm the director of the city's Housing and Neighborhood Services Department.
Christina Wolf, I'm the assistant to the city manager.
Kip Kendrick, Boone County Presiding Commissioner.
Bill Floria, I'm the Director of Resource Management for Boone County.
Lisa Meyer, Ward 2, City Council.
Don Waterman, Ward 5, City Council.
Nick Foster, Ward 4.
DeCarlin Seawood, City Manager.
Betsy Peters, Ward 6, City Council.
Valerie Carroll, Ward 1, City Council.
Barbara Buffalo, Mayor of Columbia.
Justin Aldred, I have the honor of being the Boone County Southern District Commissioner.
Janet Thompson, Boone County Northern District Commissioner.
I just introduced myself, so yeah. I think we're good.
Do you want to go? Who we also have a lot of stakeholders in the room and some staff, so
yeah.
Maybe
that'd be great.
Mm-hmm. Lacey, we'll start with you. Sorry.
Hi, I'm Lacey Salazar. I'm a graduate assistant working with North City Council.
I'm Renee Carter. I'm from Grace Matter Springs.
Shauna Johnson. I'm the engagement coordinator for the city. Rebecca Roslin, Public Health and Human Services Director.
Shaman Schwab, Boone County Public Administrator Elect.
Charles Dodd with the Columbia Tribune.
Hi, Stacey Button, Economic Development Director.
Randy Cole, CEO of Columbia Health Authority.
Sheila Mead, City Clerk.
Tim Tenney, City Community Development Director.
Jennifer Duper, the Housing Programs Manager for the City.
Hi, I'm Mackenzie Ortiz. I'm the Planning and Zoning Commissioner, and I work for Local Motion.
Susie Abula, Community Manager.
Thank you all. Like Joanne said,
Brian.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks everyone for being here. It's this collaboration and this teamwork is, I think, the only way we're going to make any movements in the realm of affordable housing. And we've had the study now for about 2 months. That's given staff a time to really work through it and digest it. Hopefully it's given you all some time to also look at it. And I know we've all been talked at a lot about the study and what it says. I think Dr. Boston did a really great job at the summit giving an overview of kind of the market data that he collected. And that presentation is available both on the county's website and on the city's website. So if you haven't seen it or you weren't able to be at the summit, I'd encourage you to go back and view that or view his presentation. He's got the slide. We have the slides on there as well. But what we really want today to be is a work session and an ability to kind of facilitate the conversation about what the recommendations are from the housing study. Staff, we're here to talk to you all about what our thoughts are on their recommendations, but we'd really like to encourage you all to just engage in conversation about them and what your thoughts are on them. And so we've got the implementation summary up here of the recommendations. So for each recommendation, the consultant put forth who the responsible stakeholders for implementing that recommendation would be and what the recommended time frame of implementation would be, ranging from short term to long term. As stated up there, short term is 0 to 2 years, midterm is 3 to 6 years, and long term is more than 6 years. And I also have copies of the recommendations from the housing study. If anybody would like a hard copy of those to work through, let me know and I can hand you one. But my thought now is just to start at the beginning of the recommendations. They're divided up into four categories, development, preservation, sustainability, and empowerment. My thought is to start with the development theme and the first recommendation under that and move through them. If you all have a different thought on how you would like this to go or a different way that you all would prefer to work through, and we can do that too.
I'm fine with that for going through. I think it would be useful to know for some of these what work's already been happening. You know, I know for some of this, you know, staff has already kind of started some of these processes. So it would be good to know kind of like an update on that and also just some feedback that is needed from us.
Yeah. Definitely do that.
I don't know if Kip has any other thoughts on.
No, I think that's a good way. Yeah.
Mayor.
Yeah, Don.
Real quick. For my edification, the goal of today is then to kind of take these recommendations and prioritize. Is that what we're looking at achieving today, or?
I think so. I think part of it, and to give feedback too on staff for prioritizing for some of them, like where we see and getting their feedback on where they see that we can actually see movement happening. Like we heard on Monday night, the conversation, like some of the stuff staff's already working on, like the flow chart for how things work, and then looking at the expedited, I mean, just talking about these things will be useful for us to kind of just keep repeating it.
I think, too, the county can share what they're doing already with each one of these things. Mm-hmm. I know Bill and Kevin and I talked, and I know Bill's doing a lot of work on this as well. So
I can get us started, if we want, with the first recommendation, which is to create predictable and streamlined review processes. And again, the study goes into a bit more detail about what they mean by this, but the idea is that from the study that the development review process is often an overlooked factor that determines the cost of new homes. And so the study recommends addressing issues to make the review process less confusing, more predictable, and less reliant on discretionary hearings. Some things that the city council has done in the past year, I think that are in line with this, are the amendments that you all have made to the accessory dwelling unit ordinance, and then also amendments to allow existing non-conforming lots to be able to be developed on in a more streamlined way. Some things that we are currently working on in this area are the approval of a process flow chart, and Tim, feel free to chime in at any point if you want to. The community development staff is working with our project management office to create flowcharts for each development process that really, you know, sets forth what each step of that process is in a visual way. And so the hope is that this is not only a tool for outside developers and builders to be able to easily see what steps would need to be taken for any given project, but also can be a tool for us internally to reflect and say, where are some of these bottlenecks happening in the development process? Where are things that could maybe be changed that are currently discretionary approval requirements that could be administrative? So we're hoping that really serves both of those focuses. Two zoning code changes that have come up. One, the Planning and Zoning Commission is currently working on, they have been for some time now, regarding small lot integration. And that's the idea of integrating small lots into the existing zoning district structure. which in turn reduces some of the regulatory barriers that would otherwise be obtained or need to be obtained in order to get the zoning regulations and requirements to build on those smaller lots. So if those are allowed just by right in all zoning districts, that decreases some of those discretionary review requirements. Another zoning code change that has been discussed, I don't believe that any work has been started at the Planning and Zoning Commission on it, but is adjusting our definition of family. Currently, there are limits on the number of unrelated people that can be in R1 and R2, and so the idea is to amend that definition of family to allow some more density in all of those zoning districts as well. That would be subject to the limits of the size of a house and the size of the rooms within the house, and that would guide the number of people that could be in any given home.
Is the county doing something similar to this, or planning to do something similar to this, or?
We have some similar things that we're doing and planning to do. We're working with a software firm right now, developing a statement of work for a contract to provide permit software, permit processing software. And part of that is mapping our current workflows for all of our development projects and permit processes, and using their expertise to look at those workflows and help us refine those and make them more streamlined, and maybe implement best practices in the industry that we might not be aware of. We're also looking at trying to convert some of our discretionary approvals to administrative approvals with criteria, so it's more predictable not only for us but for the applicants as well.
What is Ashland doing in Centralia? I mean, do they have separate planning and zoning commissions, and do they have different rules?
I realize this is more county question, so I don't want a long answer. But
are they doing any? Do they have anything specific, or do they go with the county?
Yes, to both your previous questions, they have separate zoning, and they do their own processes. We do their building inspections, but that's all. We don't have any kind of a policy establishment or policy guideline program with any of those communities.
Okay. And then my last question is, why is that not a short term? I mean, why are these not? Is it going to take more than 2 years to predictably and streamline a review process? Do we think it's going to take really like 3 to 6 years?
I think to fully accomplish some of the recommendations that are within the study, that's maybe more of a long term, but the idea here is that there's things within this realm that we can start working on now to make it a more predictable and streamlined process.
And from the county commission standpoint, and I certainly can't and won't speak for the city, but we've certainly directed Bill and his team, Bill is the director, to anything you want to propose on moving from a discretionary to administrative review, we are fully supportive of that conversation. And we understand, right, that it is ultimately checking some of our power on a legislative side of things. But we feel that it is important and a necessary step. We feel comfortable having that conversation on checking our power on discretionary review, trying to move as much as we can from discretionary to administrative. And so Bill's been told, whatever you feel good about bringing, just bring it up. Let's have that discussion.
Valerie also had a question.
Yeah, I had a few questions. I would be interested to hear how the county or entities within the county evaluate definition of family, or not definition of family, evaluate occupancy. Do other codes include a definition of family with number of related persons, or do you have a different mechanism?
We have a zoning regulation that defines family as up to four unrelated individuals or any number of related individuals.
And it doesn't matter if it's R1 or R2.
Does not.
That's the difference. That's the thing that we've needed to change for a long time.
That is a slight step better. I definitely would recommend reviewing the International Property Maintenance Codes to implement that, and perhaps combining that with some kind of parking requirements, because it's not just the capacity of the house. The other question that I had, I know that in 2023, our planning department, looking at Tim Teddy over there, actually did a considerable amount of work to move away from plan development, PD zoning. We identified that as a discretionary process that causes a lot of lots to remain undeveloped. At one point, there were several aging PD plans that we encouraged to move to street zoning. And this came freshly in my mind because last night I received a phone call from a constituent wanting to know what is a PD plan and why can't she do things with her property. And so I referred her to the city call center to talk to somebody from planning. But I wonder if there are more aging PD properties that are underdeveloped that we can, you know, that could be another recommendation.
I think that they are, that community development is actively looking at those areas that are zoned plan district that haven't been developed for the purpose of potentially zoning them to straight zoning. And they're, I don't know where you all are at in that process, Tim, but I know that they're actively engaged in that.
Researching all the plan districts and kind of categorizing them by developed, begun to develop, but not complete, and then not yet even started. And a lot of times, a plan development is a particular individual's plan, and they've sold the property, and whoever has acquired it, that's not their. So that becomes an issue because it's really a custom zoning.
Yeah.
And our consultant in 2017 said, break your habit of using plant districts so freely. And we have, as Carol knows, Plant Commission's seen a number of conversions back from plant district to base zoning, which is by right. So.
Yeah. Can you tell me where we are on the small lots? I thought that was... Is that nearing a date when you would anticipate it moving towards council for public hearing?
Yes, there's been a lot of work session discussions of it, and I think we now need to push the commission to give their blessing to kind of take it out for public input and get the development industry looking at it and seeing how that would work. And for those that haven't followed this, Thompson mentioned it, it's integrating smaller lot sizes in our very large inventory of single family zoning. So that becomes a by right matter, for example, using what we've been calling cottage size lots. And those, as council knows, there's been, I think, four or five subdivisions that have gone to council that are cottage subdivisions and a few are in production now. But they go through a multi-step process, several discretionary reviews just to get the privilege of doing a smaller than 7,000 square foot lot. So
right.
We want to just make that more of a by right. There could be some, there would be some standards that accompany that. So expectations like
ironically,
the size of the homes, for example.
Yeah, two of those cottage style that went through actually went PD. To avoid the multi-step process. So when PD is easier, we have a problem. So do you have like, I don't know, do you expect this to come to council this year? Not in 2024, but like within 2025. This year and then the fall winter.
And actually that's a question I think for a lot of the things. If you guys have an expected timeline for them of which we might actually see something or you need the feedback, it would be good to know on any of them, right?
Yeah,
if you communicate that you want to see it sooner rather than later, I'll make sure I pass that on to the PNC and their liaison so we can get you up on it. At least get a report back to you.
Tim, can I ask, you said it's kind of, you feel like PNC Commission needs to feel the pressure that we want to, you know what I mean? Is it because to go to the public engagement piece, are we at like the wordsmithing part or why have we not gone to, or you know what I mean? What's holding it up there?
It wasn't drafted into an ordinance yet, so that's the next step, see how it looks important.
Okay.
She's a PNC commissioner.
I know. Sorry. Yeah.
I think
eliminate PV, aging PV plans, do you wait for the people who own the properties with PV zoning to contact you? Or I seem to recall contacting persons who had aging plans and asking them to rezone. Is that something that planning departments is still actively doing? And do we have any mechanism to waive fees for that rezoning?
Second part first, we don't for fees. And then the first part of your question, you know, we haven't been going out and soliciting those kinds of changes. It's been a voluntary process where individuals have come forward. Now, there may have been a conversation where it's been suggested, but typically it's a representative of a property that brings the matter up, and we might intervene and say, hey, have you considered doing mixed-use commercial zoning or some other constituents?
The way that I see that is that, you know, they're identifying the properties right now, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my assumption was they identify the properties which fall within this category, you know, that have, especially the third one you said, have not started anything, and then reach out to the property owners. My assumption is you'll probably come to council and be like, this is what we've identified, and then we kind of give that direction of, yes, please reach out about redeveloping it or the zoning and what their process will be for that. Yeah,
Nick. Just really quickly, Becky mentioned a process flow chart, and I'm assuming that that's going to be, that we'll find a lot of these kinds of things along that flow chart once it's developed. Does that make sense? And you're thinking of that with each of these areas? Is that right?
Well, so I think the flow chart's going to be really helpful, and I'm sorry I was having another conversation at the beginning of your comment there. So I missed that.
Can I ask a question?
You know, I think the hope with the flow chart is that it kind of points us back that we can look at what the process is for. I mean, we understand what the process is, right? But when you see it laid out like that, we can pinpoint and understand the timing it takes to get from one point in the process to this point where those bottlenecks are happening. And then it can also say, like, is there anything in here that is currently discretionary that could be administrative? And with that, kind of keeping in mind a lot of the, you know, subdivision and planning requirements are statutory, and so there's certain things that have to go to City Council for approval. But maybe there's some portions of that we can take out and make administrative.
Because I was the cause of Becky. So two things. Number one, I don't know if y'all got this thing from the Columbia Board of Realtors this morning. And so just FYI, one of their recommendations for both city and county is to discourage the use of planned districts. So I think that's been chimed in on again from the Columbia Board of Realtors. So just to put that on the table. The other question and what I was asking Becky about was in terms of the definition of family, and as we move forward with that, thinking about sewer, right?
Yes.
Because that drives most of what we talk about is sewer, but also parking spaces if you're in certain neighborhoods. So just, it seems like, you know, as we think through that, to look at those two issues. Because, you know, it may not be, it may not matter if you're related, but it may matter how many times that toilet gets flushed.
That's pointed out in the housing study,
right,
in a couple of places.
Those are the things that really drive
down to.
Yep.
Is there anything else anybody wants to touch on in this particular recommendation under the development recommendations?
R2 and RMF zoning and the overabundance of R1 within the city of Columbia.
So no, I don't think collectively as a group. I know that's, you know, a comment that comes up.
I don't know if it goes best with this item on the matrix.
It probably goes either here or I think there's another kind of catch-all for other zoning code and plan revisions, but I think here is just as appropriate time as any to talk about it.
So within Columbia, our latest inventory of zoned land, we had over 80%, I believe, R1 among residentially zoned. And over the years, it's been the most rapidly growing zone, where R2 and RMF have not grown as fast. In the very most recent years, that's changed a little bit. There's a slowing growth of R1, but it's still growing comparatively. We don't have very much of R2 RMF, and that limits the places that we can add density. So things like the small lot gives us the ability to add density in all zones, and I think that's great. I think we need to look to other forms of density because we have a need not only for small houses, but also for multifamily and duplex, and we don't have a lot of inventory of those. And the very controversial topic related to that is R1 zoning reform. I don't know if that's the route we want to go, but I hope that we start considering that for looking at mechanisms to add R2 and RMF.
That fits in with another one of the recommendations from the Columbia board.
Lisa?
I think that fits in with the recommendation.
She's saying she can't hear you.
One of the recommendations from the Columbia board on their letter on number 2 for City of Columbia, it says make the process for down zoning requests to R1 more stringent. That would reduce the spot zoning that has been created in residential districts. So that's another overlapping, like we're hearing it was in the study, we're hearing it from people in the field.
It's really interesting how we approach the R1 down zoning. So a lot of neighborhoods felt development pressure, it was recommended to some of the central neighborhoods, recommended by the city to downzone, and we waived fees to do that in one case where several people did it together. And it does create a spot downzoning. I don't know if it's been effective for the purpose it was hoped for. One of the things that I look at would be looking at our overlay zones to add some protections in terms of conservation of naturally occurring affordable housing. And I think that would help protect some of the pressures that they're feeling in a way that's conscientious of the neighborhood and the desire for growth as well. And there are ways that you can carry that on that. What I would hope is to bring more equity between R1 and R2 as we look to discourage downzoning and as we look to add more R2 RMF. Something that people bring up to me frequently is the front door facing, which is required in R1, but not required in R2. That's something that may make it easier to propose those kinds of buildings neighboring R1 or even in areas that are predominantly single family, regardless of their zoning. So we do have a lot of single family homes on R2 and RMF lots in Central City.
Two other things involved that if it's okay if I
Yeah, absolutely, please.
Some of the things that the county's looking at, and just going off of the recommendation, so if I reference like 1.2, I'm referencing the actual housing study. So 1.2 was an office coordinator ombudsman's recommendation, and that's something that we are having a discussion on. This afternoon, we will adopt the FY25 budget that has funding placed in contingency for that position, because there's still a lot to talk through and work through before that position is ultimately posted and hired. But working with Bill and his team to have an office coordinator there that can kind of run interference and get those, kind of be proactive, get those answers for developers, for people coming in, and help streamline everything, and maybe time to time bug the staff, like, hey, where is this at? Are they scheduled yet? And facilitating that conversation. So that position will be budgeted, ongoing conversation before it gets posted. I have listed under admin side for kind of streamlining review process. We've had this conversation. This is something that Bill brought up at the housing study meeting, but something we want certainly to empower him to do would be on ADUs, coming up with a menu of pre-approved design plans, whether that be 15 to 20 plus pre-approved ADU design plans that can, you know, developers can go through, or whoever, property owners can go through and select from, in order to know that those have already been cleared through a process. If you're doing an ADU, I suspect it's smaller. You want to reduce your obviously reducing your footprint, probably want to reduce your costs as much as possible too. And so, if we can work with on finding some of those pre-approved plans and giving them a menu option to choose from.
So, Kip, I'd encourage, and Bill, I don't know if you've ever reached out to some of your colleagues, but I know, like, the city of Boise, Idaho, they actually went down this path, and they found no one took it up. So I think just to maybe talk to some peers and be like, because I know City of Kansas City did something similar with trying to, if people want to stay in their, you know, World War II home, you know, what add-ons could they do? And they created plants and dolphins, and then, like, no one did it. So I just encourage you to reach out to just make sure, because I agree, like, I would want this off the shelf. This is already almost pre-approved. I can go and do this. But just to make sure that they get, you know, somebody uses
that there's
it.
A demand.
Well, it's yeah. Not just, demand, but also that, like, yeah, the staff time is, you know, worth it. But, yeah, I know I talked to the mayor of Boise, because this is something that they spent some of their ARPA funds on. I was going through this process, and then they were like, well, that was a waste of our money. Yeah. So, yeah.
So I'm curious,
I don't know the details. This is just a comment.
Building ADUs using their own plans, or were they
this
just
a question
not building
Boise.
ADUs?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That actually brings up another question. I know.
Well, hold on, I was going to see if he was.
Oh, sorry.
No, you're good. So something else that we were discussing, and this is kind of the smaller lot conversation from your side, but from our side, it's more of those irregular shaped lots that may come up during subdivision plats or requests to rezone and find properties. And so working with developers on subdivisions on what would kind of be an irregular shaped lot that may not be buildable under current regulations, on making providing access to build on those with the incentive that it is a smaller footprint home, becomes more affordable development. So we've heard that from some local builders. You know, Russ Anderson has put that on my radar. Hey, there are some lots that just end up sitting empty for green space, that if we had the ability to kind of think outside the box, we'd put smaller footprint homes on those within larger subdivisions. Some of my notes I can't read. 1.6, which was a tax increment financing without ripping off this Band-Aid. And this would be not from the city. This is not the county side, because we don't have statutory authority to do TIFs. I believe the city does. I'm not interested in starting that. But I will just echo that I was very impressed with our trip to Madison last year and kind of what they did on using TIFs for affordable housing and mixed-use developments, larger multifamily developments. I thought
transit-oriented. It was
right.
A transit-oriented development, too.
Yeah, and what they had, you know, I mean, we know that every time a TIF conversation comes up in the city, it becomes a battle, right? Because it tends to be a developer bringing the TIF idea forward and presenting it. And I was really impressed with how they got beyond that, those individual skirmish battles, was just like, let's just have this up front in the development of a policy. Let's have the community weigh in on how they want to see TIFs used. And so it was, I'm sure it was a very, very much more longer term discussion and policy development on using TIFs for affordable housing. But I almost feel like that's something that even people within our community who may kind of be averse to TIFs or the idea of a TIF may be more willing to get behind if it is for larger multifamily development of affordable housing.
And so in Madison and in like Lincoln, Nebraska, they've both used that. And they put in the requirements that it's for this really a public good, right? It's not just to spur development, it's to spur this type of development. Lincoln, Nebraska also put in, I don't know if they still have this, but they used to have requirements that it was also like, and then it also has to be energy efficient above a certain, you know, like basically it helped bridge the gap between the neighbors who were against this idea of using tax incremental financing for a project, because it was actually creating an affordable housing unit because it was energy efficient. Some of them had to have requirements about renewable energy on site. Like, so some of those things I also agree work if it is our policy that's coming forward,
yep.
Not a piecemeal project coming towards us.
And that's generally what we see now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we as in the collective we.
You watching from the
sidelines.
That's
right, right. Yeah.
Yeah, Nick.
Just to piggyback a little on what Kip said, one about TIFs, that was one of my main takeaways from the trip to Madison, was the way they used it. And it was about the way that they framed the conversation. And I think in this community, a lot of when we've had TIF projects come forward, they've been seen by the public very often as simply benefiting the developer. And in Madison, it was about the public good. And I think that is how we would need to frame it and present it in an authentic way. So I was glad to see TIF show up in the study, and it's something that I would hope we would definitely pursue. The other thing is about an ombudsperson. I almost asked this question about something that was on our agenda for Monday, and then I decided not to for whatever reason. I had a lot of questions, but I think that is a great idea, because especially as we're changing things, I think that people, especially who've been developing and building in our community for a while, are going to need some help in how they do it. So whether that's an individual person, as you're suggesting, which I think is a great idea, or in some other way, I think we're going to have to be able to clearly describe the changes and in such a way that it encourages people to take advantage of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Tim might be able to speak to this a little bit more about how, you know, any given developers walked through the process, but I think there is also somebody from the economic development that assists in walking developers through that process. Is that right, Tim?
Yes. Yeah, Ray, he has business development specialist. She's available, and that's particularly for someone who needs some extra help navigating the process, meaning mm-hmm. they're a first-time customer mm-hmm. or their small business. Something where it's overwhelming to process all this information. We probably could use some in-house customer service person or persons to help people navigate the system from within too. And there are some building departments or planning and building departments that do that as well. And we do it on a very modest scale with the single family permits, where we have a senior building inspector is always in the office to provide customer service at the counter with people that need some help with the applications. But we can expand that to commercial permitting.
And I would say that the creative position has really leaned into more of the commercial development, so it's mm-hmm. not on residential development.
Right.
And so the thought is that we need somebody for residential, then that's something that we need to put into our process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will keep moving us along. So the next thing that I wanted to make sure we talked about is the local housing trust fund. So the study recommends that both the city and county set up a local trust fund for housing. And the idea here is that you have, you know, a locally established fund that can be used to support affordable housing projects in a way that's more flexible and more able to immediately address the community's housing needs than having funding that comes from the federal government, which can't always be that flexible. So we, the city in 2025, budgeted for $1 million to go towards the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. The step we're at now is figuring out what are going to be the parameters of the fund. What do we want the funding priorities to be? How do we want that to be administered? I've put some thoughts as to what staff is thinking the needs are and how that could be best used. I would love to get your all's feedback or direction from that. My thought at this point is to kind of have two different funding categories. One primary portion of the Affordable Housing Trust Fund would be for capital subsidies for affordable housing projects. And we would develop priorities for how those, you know, applications would be accepted and reviewed. There would be an annual application process. It would presumably be competitive because presumably we would get applications for more funding than what we have available. And those would be reviewed. I'm hesitant. A lot of affordable housing trust funds have separate boards that review and make recommendations to the city council. We have a lot of boards and commissions. I'm somewhat hesitant to propose establishing a new board or commission for just for this fund. I think the Housing and Community Development Commission would have the capability of, you know, and that's, you know, what, where their expertise lies in, of reviewing and making recommendations. So for maybe 80% of the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, those funds are towards larger affordable housing projects. And maybe they're not always large, but ideally, we get some larger developments coming through, and then we can set up priorities. Then maybe we look at priorities being long-term affordability, right? Are you going to have affordability that's greater than 50 years? Or are you going to provide affordable units for someone that's very low or extremely low AMI, so like 30% or 50% AMI? And so we can really have the flexibility to establish what our needs are as a community and prioritize that when we're making decisions about who to fund from these applications.
You talked a little bit about TIF financing, which I imagine would pay into that fund.
Possibly, because so most times TIFs are geared toward the particular project.
Right.
So it's more project-oriented, so
okay.
It's not something that's just could be community-wide.
It would be going back to that, to those projects that are within that TIF district.
But the discussion of the linkage fee or impact fees in the report, that was intended to pay into.
Yeah, so we'll get to like the second, I think the first part of this conversation is, at least the way I envision it, is what we want the funding priorities to be from the fund. And then the second and much harder part of the conversation is how we come up with a dedicated revenue source for the fund. Because right now, I mean, the city council has chosen to put essentially some seed money into the fund, right, from the general revenue fund excess reserves. But ultimately, if this is going to be sustainable and going to be, you know, a tool that our community can rely on to increase affordable housing, you've got to have a dedicated revenue source.
This is one of the things I'm excited about with this, and I think the funding is going to be an interesting conversation moving forward. 80-20, I don't know.
Yeah.
To me, it's we need to keep in mind what's the end of this supposed to be? And one of the things that I think is beneficial about this study is it does give us some numbers for what we can anticipate with specific types of housing and what those housing needs are. So everyone, R1, R2, and so forth, general density, multifamily. I'm a big fan of mixed income housing. There's a lot of reasons that are beyond just what it provides for different groups within the community. So I think there'll be competing interests for this as well. But when we're going to be dependent on developers, builders to make this happen, and I'm assuming that when a builder determines I want to do this project, they sit down, they do a spreadsheet, which is one of the reasons I'm not a builder. I don't like spreadsheets. Not my world. But and they come up with figures that make it work. So that for me, the Housing Trust Fund is one of those instruments that we can use that helps to make that work. So that we know that there's going to be some level of incentivization that takes place. There's already some there's some controversy, I think, about linkage fees. There is a payoff for the linkage fees, too, that's proposed. So it's about being sure that all of that is understood going forward. But keeping in mind, what do we want to have at the end of it? What do we want to see?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right. At the end of the day, people in this room can probably speak to this much better than I can, but you can't build a house that is affordable for somebody making 50% of the area median income and not lose money, right? There's an affordability gap there that needs to be filled if we want to provide housing that is affordable for somebody at a particular income level. And so hopefully that this can be used for that, and we can target those development goals from the housing study with the projects that we're supporting.
This is already done in the community. Community Land Trust is one of those. Habitat for Humanity is another good example. And other chotos that build housing, it's the same model. With the recognition that in order to provide opportunities for housing ownership in particular, there have to be these other instruments that come into the work.
And then the other thing I'll put out there, I think the other use for the fund, the one thing that I've heard a lot in the time that I've been in this position is whether or not we can waive building fees or utility connection fees, and that becomes problematic because those fees cover the cost to provide those, right? And so if we start waiving more, that throws us off in a different way. But we could, I think, use the funds from this to reimburse for those fees for affordable housing projects, which may be another, and that would be a much smaller portion of the fund that's being used for that, but I think that could be another really useful use of the fund.
Can I ask a high-level question for you, Kip, or for County Commission? So for some of these, this is obviously looking at all of Boone County when it's showing those projected numbers of growth. Do you feel that the county, when we're trying to think about ways to incentivize additional housing units being built, do you feel that like the county has more, they feel they more want the pressure to be on those happening in this incorporated parts of Boone County? And I'm assuming. So then, what role then, if we talk about this idea of a local housing trust, and it's listed as both city and county in the recommendations of this idea, is the idea then to help support the incorporated areas of Boone County for those developments, or do you see it that is something that should happen in the unincorporated areas?
Well, we want to see infill as much as possible resources standpoint, both on ag land, but also, and we're certainly not opposed to, we'll continue to see development happen in unincorporated areas, no doubt. But from a best resources where availability of current utilities, that's where it has to happen, right? Denser development. And if we're adding, as we talked about, we're adding 37,000 housing units to meet the demand in the next 20 years in unincorporated areas, and we've become St. Louis County in a lot of ways, right? We've developed every square inch of Boone County that was once kind of naturally or preserved in other areas. So that infill development is going to be critical for the next 25 to 30 years and beyond. And we know our master plan, the current master plan, the way it's proposed is we give some power, more power to the municipalities, incorporated areas, kind of around the periphery of cities and municipalities across Boone County, where we want the cities to have more influence and more of a say on how that development is going to happen in and around those areas. And so that's something that the master plan proposes. We understand that there's going to likely be a request for denser development in certain areas that will be reflected in the master plan, but infill is critical. And if I may, that kind of segues into a conversation I wanted to have on the housing, or we wanted to have, I think. I hope I can be our voice on this and get it out correctly. Feel free to jump in. Not to push back against what you're proposing, but I think it's great. I think if this were to be, I don't know I should say, I don't know if we have the capability in Boone County government right now to stand up kind of a housing trust fund and have that be, and then have two separate housing trust funds within, you know, Boone County, right? One within the city, one within the county. I think if this were to happen and jointly done, we would be open to the idea of it being kind of a quasi-governmental agency, something like a Columbia Area Jobs Foundation, which I know is recently disbanded, but something that is quasi-governmental where it can be, I know you want to get away from this, but kind of a city-county board appointment process where we can, the city and county can provide direction on what those criteria are, what, you know, how, when RFPs go out, RFPs go out, but it is kind of driven by that board. I think you also, we would have the benefit at that point of if it's outside of both of our governmental structures to a certain extent, you have the ability for them to capture funds that we can't capture, such as, I mean, is there ability for end of the year donations to come in for tax write-off purposes? Do they have the ability to work more closely with banks for CRA credits? If it were a bit more independent of both of our current government structures, does it give them a bit more flexibility on bringing down additional funds, both locally, nationally, state, banks? And I know that this complicates things, right? Because and if this is an ongoing conversation while you kind of stand up the process for the Housing Trust Fund and see what's out there, and that conversation may take a bit more to unfold.
But it would also, at the same time, it would have the ability then to, I think, have the broader impact across the county. Because you're seeing the same things that are happening in Columbia are happening in these other municipalities, just on a smaller scale. And, you know, what we don't want, as Kip said, in those smaller municipalities is building, at, you know, starting out here and then trying to infill, right? Let's create that infill and then have them expand. And so I think it's, you know, that's more mindful of their infrastructure, more mindful of what's happening there and helping them build their tax base at the same time. You know, so I think that's a better way to look at it. And if that entity were set up in that way, I think it would, while it would have some oversight through the appointment process, it wouldn't be just so tied to Columbia or so tied to the county that the smaller municipalities might not participate. Mm-hmm. We have to find ways to get them engaged so that this thing works, because the affordable housing is an issue across the county.
I agree.
It is across the county. I mean, you see it firsthand every day.
Do you see that the other municipalities would be interested in having appointment opportunities to that board and also financial or fiduciary kind of like responsibilities with contributing?
Well, I mean, I think that those are details you have to work out, right? I mean, we would want, I don't know that the city's in a position right now to commit $1 million to a trust fund such as the city. We would certainly want. We certainly understand that a lot of our tax revenue that is generated comes from within residents of the city of Columbia as Boone County residents. I mean, I don't think we'd be asking for a disproportionate amount of money to be steered for projects outside of the city of Columbia, but giving them access to. So whether it be through board appointments, I don't know, whether it be board appointments or just more of communications, and if RFPs go out, the ability for some of the smaller communities to be able to participate in or potential for developers or however to be able to participate in those RFPs as well.
Have you seen any examples of other combined city county housing trusts?
I haven't necessarily looked at that.
I imagine they exist in places where you've got a city county, where you've got a joint governance, not like Louisville and Jefferson County, for instance, and
Philadelphia.
I'm not sure about Knoxville and Knox County.
I bet Philadelphia does.
Yeah. So I think there probably are models out there. I think that one of the reasons I'm pleased that we had a housing study that encompasses all of Boone County is because we are impacting one another. There's no question about that, and really beyond the county lines. But whatever we can do, I think, to work collaboratively, we should definitely explore. We have an example of how this works already between us with PHHS. We do work collaboratively in that way, and part of what happens there, I guess, are funding decisions too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So definitely. It's not like we haven't done this before, or that we don't have a model for it even here. I think we do have that model, and I think it is a worthy idea. In fact, one of my questions was when we looked at the housing trust fund. I thought, well, the city's done it. What about the county? I'm wondering about the county here, too.
Right, and even when I say, like, you know, the county's participation as county as a whole, like, understanding the city of Columbia is within Boone County, right, and money that comes in through any mechanism that we put in place would just as well go to projects within the city of Columbia limits as it would in, you know, Hallsville, Centralia, Ashland. And I don't want to look like we're trying to, like, hey, give us the stable, let us have that city money, right? It's not that. It is more of just like if this were a joint effort, quasi-governmental, could it open up for additional funding opportunities?
Yeah. Well, again, that's already true. At Joanne's office, there are a lot of those funds that come from the county go into the city of Columbia to meet community service needs. So. Again, I think we've got that kind of model.
Okay. I mean, I think the parameters could be set up to guide that, right, as far as percentages and where those are spent, and that kind of has it built into the structure of any housing trust fund. I want to say, I don't know this for sure, I want to say whatever county Boulder is in, Boulder, Colorado, is it Boulder County?
It's Boulder County.
I think they might have a housing trust fund that funds all municipalities in the county.
Okay.
And that they have a countywide, I think, tax that goes to, but I haven't looked into it in any detail, but
okay.
I will do that.
Barnes Housing Trust in Davidson County, Tennessee, is a city county combination trust, housing trust that works for affordable housing.
Does anybody want to have discussion about funding sources for an affordable housing trust fund? I mean, the study goes into some detail about what the various funding sources have been for different housing trust funds, from, you know, economic development sales taxes to linkage fees to permitting fees to property taxes. And I don't know if anyone has any discussion that they would like to have on that now or not. And,
I would stay away from additional fees that are going towards it directly. I think that will not build goodwill and friendships. I think it will be best to have some sort of philanthropy-driven donations from banks, direct philanthropy.
It's probably going to have to be, as most of projects, you know, a three-legged stool, public, private, and fee generated. It's probably going to have to be all three, a combination, and just looking at that and seeing what's equitable. I mean, that's usually how things work, and it's just trying not to overburden one to make it, as you say, to destroy good relationships, but to say it's part of the process, and we have to create a balance to go forward so that that initial $1 million doesn't get used and then say, oops, we're done. Mm-hmm. We have to find a way to sustain it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually the...
Well, we always have to think about that. Always ends up to the consumer. So my thought was, we can go deeper in that direction at some point, but my thought was, is philanthropy, looking at, you know,
for
direct donations, and then...
But that's like the part of the private... Is the financial the philanthropic piece to say this is a good piece to do? So I think that's one of the stools, the legs of the stool,
as an option.
Yeah, or as part of it, as part of how it's set up.
Cobalt gifts.
I do want to say that I think that some of the slow progress that we have is due to a reliance on not-for-profits and the limited number and size of the not-for-profits that are active. And I do think we should look towards making investments to help grow those not-for-profits, but I think we need to look at both private and not-for-profit funding. Ultimately, TIF funding goes to the consumer as well. Anyway, I was interested by the outline provided in the report for impact fees. They seem to suggest that impact fees are usually on commercial, since commercial generates jobs which have a need for more housing. A study would be useful to, like they described, to identify how much a fee would be practical and how much development can be expected to occur that would generate that fee. As well as, you know, we certainly don't want to make a fee that discourages development, but we do want to encourage development of affordable housing. So is this, I like
the linkage fee.
It's a linkage fee.
This is a linkage fee.
Yeah.
I like the model of having development, commercial development pay into affordable housing. Because that is a fee that wouldn't apply to affordable housing development, and it will, in a way, incentivize the development of affordable housing by, I guess, for-profits as well. Whatever we can do to make it more profitable to build will favor more building.
I think you also need to analyze some of the impacts of those linkage fees. Mm-hmm. Most of the development that's occurred in town has occurred because we've done, you know, Chapter 100 bonds, we've done something to encourage that development to occur. And so adding a fee on top of a development may push that development someplace else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Neutralize
mentioned in
the
study.
Incentives.
And this is, I thanks for bringing that up to Carla, because some of the larger developments that would produce the largest amount of money through a linkage fee, if we commission at this point, is ultimately making a decision on Chapter 100. If we're doing a Chapter 100 abatement that is directly taking money out of the school districts, and then we're turning around and saying, hey, but we want this money at City County, I'm feeling the school district like, well, what do you guys, what's going on here? What did you guys just do to increase the fee but then abate the, yeah, I think there'd be a very real conversation with Sister Foot or subdivision.
Well, I want to be careful that, I mean, this is, we could talk about linkage fees probably for the rest of the meeting, but, you know, that the basic idea, the linkage fee is one possibility for funding the kind of activities we're talking about, and for me, what I would like to see coming out of this meeting is some idea about who's going to take responsibility for any particular element of this.
Yeah.
So we could talk about we could talk about any one of these things for a long time. I know work is happening already in each of these issues. So when it comes to linkage fees and tax increment financing, housing trust fund, who's going to carry the ball from this point moving forward to advance what we need to see happen in order to create the housing that we need? You know, who does that responsibility fall to?
Well, it's I think it depends on what you're trying to, what you're looking at. And so, I mean, we have an economist that works for the city. And so we can do some of those metrics and see exactly what, if we talk about additional tax, what could that generate? If we're talking about, you know, certain fees, what does that generate? And so we can do those, but it's really trying to understand what process we're asking them to analyze.
Mm-hmm. We also have some areas of our city that are really desiring development that are having a hard time getting development.
Absolutely.
So we're only going to make it a little harder to get development in those areas. So just, you know, we don't want to find ourselves in a situation where we're shooting ourselves in the foot.
Well, right. And my question is just how do we make that determination?
We can. Matthew Lou's not here, so I can volunteer his staff to do some number crunching to kind of see what could be some potential possibilities.
If I may, I think the determination of that is the product of the Nexus study.
Right.
So, in my view, we should get the ball rolling on the Nexus study so we're able to make more informed decisions. We talked about, who will be pursuing each of these items. It does list that it would, in this study, that it would be most effective in the city of Columbia. But ideally, both the city and county.
I think so. At the same time, I'm hearing that as we're thinking about prioritization, that there's a lot more concerns over at least the example model of what it might end up being.
Sure.
That, because I know, like, you know, when we talk about that, there's a few other studies recommended in here, and do we want to kind of prioritize that one over the other? And I'm referring to, like, the housing preservation inventory, and just thinking of some of those other things. And I'm only more thinking about, like, what to expect in the next 3 to 6 months, 2 years, you know.
Yeah.
So just wondering, I appreciate, Dick Herlin, you offering up Matt Lou, since he's not here, to evaluate just some of those examples before we start too far down something that we don't know would get wide support.
Right. This is part of what I'm talking about, though. Like, the study helps us identify and flesh out what those concerns are and how much impact those concerns have. If we don't do the study, we may not have a well-defined concern, and we may not be fully understanding why we don't want to pursue this, right? I think we need to go into this knowing how each choices impact not only housing, but the economic forces present in Columbia, including job creation.
Yeah. I have a question. We're just hypothetical anyway, but if we're seriously discussing linkage fees for commercial development, a company comes in and says we're going to build a multi-story, multi-family apartment complex, is that considered commercial development? And aren't we then kind of circling around saying, oh, we're going to put it on as commercial development to promote affordable housing, but you're building affordable housing?
I think the idea was, so it's more of those large job centers. And so let's say you get somebody who wants to come in and they're going to bring in an office complex is going to bring in 200 employees. And the idea is now you have those employees that are going to be part of this. And so it's
that's an easy commercial. That's, you know, or industrial in that. But what I want to make sure of is that we don't inadvertently include that commercial development for somebody building an apartment complex, you know, as if we go down, and that's down the road, if we decide to do that and as we craft the ordinance.
Part of the discussion.
Yeah.
And I did want to make a quick note for those who had RSVP'd, there is some box lunches over there on the counter in case you're hungry while you're sitting here. So, Christine, thank you, Dick Herlin and staff, for grabbing some for us. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Because I know we're making people work through lunch, so.
I would suggest that housing developments that have a certain percentage reserved for affordable dwelling units would not be subject to the land use fee.
Listen, that can be part of the ordinance, listen.
Please go on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the only other thing in development recommendations that we haven't really talked about that is joint city and county was the pro housing grant. I think if we do, I don't know if this is worth too much of our time right now because we don't know if there's going to be a round three. If there is a round three, I think that this would be a great grant to go after. I think this grant is really focused on communities that are undertaking, you know, I think studies like this to figure out what their regulatory barriers for affordable housing are. And so we'll, I think we'd be in a really great position going into this because of the work that we've done. But again, I don't, we won't know until this spring if there is going to be a round three of this grant. So until that point, I don't know that it's worth a whole lot more discussion.
I will say just quick note to both this one as well as one of the kind of bullets under the last conversation we were just having was about the low-income tax credits.
Yes.
And our the representative Smith from like the spring or not spring he's in like the Cape I forget, he's in Cape Area whatever the Southeast. He's the chair of the Ways and Means on the federal committee, and he had proposed last year pushing for increasing the numbers and percentages that go toward that, especially for our low-income tax credit. So, I think both of these kind of have this additional thing as we're talking about local priorities that we're advocating at a state and a federal level for us to like be jointly putting out together. And Kip, I'll look to you for some of those, like how can we kind of put these things to support in the different legislations so that maybe we do see support for the programs continuing as well as just to know that local impact since we have somebody in Missouri that's on that committee. Yeah.
Charging it.
Right? Yeah.
Congressman Smith has been, he was a big proponent when he was in the Missouri House as well.
Yeah, we just had a U.S. Mayor's kind of call about our housing focus, and part of it was, hey, reach out if you have a local, you know what I mean, a representative that serves in this capacity to put the help on. So just thinking about that as we're putting together different priorities to send out, that we should think about doing it together.
Yeah, that's great. You guys want to move on to preservation recommendations? All right. One is about creating a housing preservation inventory. I think there's kind of two ways to look at this. One is looking at making sure that we are working with the county, with Columbia Housing Authority, to create an inventory that's tracking all of the really all the affordable housing in the community that's affordable because it either has a subsidy that is in it and has a required period of affordability, and so that we are able to see, to see where all of those are, and then monitor their physical condition, monitor when maybe those affordability requirements are running out, so that we can strategize before we get to that point how we keep these units affordable.
Could you give an example?
Yeah, so we were talking about low-income housing tax credits earlier.
Right.
That program was started like 35 years ago and had a period of affordability for most projects that are 30 years. So we could potentially have low-income housing funded, the low-income housing tax credit funded projects in town that in 2 years their affordability period would not be required anymore, and so they could then jump to market rate. And so tracking some of those projects and then also just like what physical condition they're in, so that we don't lose those affordable units. There's a broader way to look at this, which is trying to more accurately track all of our, like even our naturally occurring affordable units in town, and I think there's value to that as well. I think we may need some more data analytic tools to be able to do that. I've talked with a couple companies that I think are able to pull a lot of information and create those inventories well, but either way, I think the first part of it, doing an inventory of all of our, you know, subsidized affordable housing in the community is a really great place to start.
And I had a question on it. So I guess I was actually kind of surprised that we didn't already know this. You know, I mean, especially when you think about some of these fundings that come through us or CHA has done. So
what do you think, like, the lift is for something like this? I actually wrote down, I was like, is this something that Dr. Boston does? Like, when he was looking at other things, did he already collect some of it, or what do you
think? I don't think the lift for identifying those properties is difficult.
Yeah.
But I think it's a lift of putting in one place that we all have access to what those properties are, when their period of affordability is up, and then some sort of tracking of their physical condition as well, how many units each one has, and more of having this, like, centralized, I think, data source that we can all be looking at. So I think it's very doable to answer your question.
Yeah. It seems like it's actually just, like,
does Randy good, have this?
It seems like it's just, like, a best management. If we put money into something that we're kind of, you know what I mean, keeping
right.
track. And then also we do for property maintenance and, you know, some of our vacant, you know what I mean? Like, we already have mechanisms. And
like, we track as a city all of the, you know, housing that we have, either, like, home or CPG funding.
Right.
So we're tracking those. The live tech finance projects, we also track, but not quite in the same way, right? Because we're not the reporting entity for compliance for a lot of those. But some of those are combination that have some of both, right?
Yeah.
And then CHA's projects as well.
Yeah.
It would be a good idea to know what we actually are responsible for, what we have, so that sounds like a reasonable thing to do.
But it'll help show the gap, too, that we know exists. And it could help us advocate for additional resources then at the state and federal level. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, is that almost a...
get it done?
Well, yeah, but a semester-long project at a Truman School or a year-long internship with Truman School or something like that. I mean, because that, I mean, almost is like...
Info's all there.
Right.
It's just putting it all together.
It
out.
Gathering it all
right.
together. And just played second of all. I wonder if that is an internship.
Let me ask our intern. Lacey, does that sound like a project that your fellow graduate students would be interested in?
100%, yes.
Yeah.
Awesome.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
This next one is, unless anybody else wants to, has comments or thoughts on the housing preservation inventory. The next one is very broad, but it's code enforcement that prioritizes keeping housing well maintained. I think, at least from a staff perspective, we've communicated with the council quite a bit about, you know, what we're doing, what we're planning to do in this area. I'm happy to talk about that more here, but if there's anything that you all want to discuss.
And this is something you guys just got permission to do, is that correct?
Very limited permission, yeah, but 2021 that we implemented this year.
Yeah.
There's like one tooth in it.
Okay.
Is it one tooth?
Yeah.
It's two sleeves.
Yeah.
My question is, this is something we're doing, and in the short term, are we looking at just upping our game with this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that would mean providing additional resources for that purpose.
Additional code enforcement officers.
Additional resources.
I think one thing we've done really, that has been a really helpful change is that we've worked with the municipal court and the municipal judge and city prosecutor on is having a dedicated docket just for property maintenance cases, because they really are unique cases than the other cases that the municipal court typically deals with. And so they're going to, in 2025, add an extra hour to that docket time that happens once a month, which I think will be useful, and just provide more time for our code enforcement officers to be meeting with the prosecutor and with the property owner and talking about ways that they can get the property into compliance.
So one of the experiences, I think, in the county has been, when I look at this dumpster days thing, you know, every time I go out in certain areas, and there's a either it's a nuisance abatement question or whatever, often it's the lack of a dumpster that has led to the condition of that property. And you know, I've been baffled by the response of some property managers and landowners in their lack of will to often to just have a dumpster there when that would just, that would keep their property in better shape. And so, you know, I've helped even, I've paid for dumpsters to be put on site for areas. But that seems like it's so easy,
mm-hmm.
and it's one of those things that if we could work with those property managers to say, gosh, make this just part of the routine.
Mm-hmm.
Have those in those neighborhoods. That really does, that goes a long way. Does it fix everything? No, but it certainly helps.
I think working for a way to have them secured is one of the challenges, because if you go to like any of our recycle areas right now, every time I'm there, it seems that I see somebody has just dumped trash in our recycle bins when they're just open.
Well, I'm not talking recycle. I'm just talking
No, dumpsters. I meant a dumpster. So there's the people who are to use them that they're for, but there's the illegal dumping
the
piece.
People that just come in
right.
and use it. Yeah.
So having, I think it's having them secured where it's actually for the intended user is one of the challenges.
Right.
Well, I think that's why it's a dumpster day, right, and not
right.
a dumpster
so month. So that's been one of the changes we made, is there we did see that problem. We were leaving dumpsters in a neighborhood for like weeks
for
at a time,
long.
And then
right.
it would just create that issue. And so we've changed the program to do like more of an event with them. And so we'll leave them there for 2 days, we'll flyer beforehand, and have our staff out there
staff
do like
on
pizza.
Hand.
One night to have people come out, and it's more of a like dumpster event.
Yeah,
I've
been to them.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that I mean, it is. It's sad when you have to have an event to clean up a neighborhood, because those conditions exist. And I think if people had the ability to do something, and that's one of the trash pickup in the county. It's not something that is county run. That's a service that you pay for. It's a private service that you pay for. And so since those landowners aren't paying that fee for the folks who live in their properties, it's an ongoing issue. And so the condition of those properties declines. And I think in part, when you're living in a place that's got trash everywhere and junk in the yards, and your kids don't feel safe, and you don't feel safe with your kids out in the yard because of all of the trash in the yard and blah blah blah. It's sort of a continual cycle.
We do have that challenge also in the city, in certain areas where we have more trash in the city. It's an unfortunate, and more litter in certain areas.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate.
More frequently for shorter times?
The dumpster days.
So,
if we increase our budget for the dumpsters.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
We can do anything if we have enough money.
But this also, to me, this is something, to the point of who should be participating in that. If I'm getting rent from those folks, I should be participating. It shouldn't solely be on the back of the city or the county. That should be part and parcel of that the property management.
Yeah.
Because it's a collaborative. They have to be involved because they get a benefit, and the benefit is greater because then they don't have this other process happening because now their property is trashed.
Yeah, both. You want both the owner and the renter both to care.
Right. Everybody needs to care.
I think that brings me back around to the rental compliance specialist and also to rental inspections. We've had some discussion about fees for rental and increased rental inspections. We need more rental compliance officers to do that. And I think that fees for the renewal of certificates can help
feed into the need to fund that position, but also perhaps things like dumpster bays. Because you're right, our dumpster days are essentially administered by the staff working with neighborhood associations. There are much fewer neighborhood associations than there are places that need dumpsters. Mm-hmm. And the most active neighborhood associations may not be in the locations that need the dumpsters.
And they're not always neighborhood associations. Like, that's not a criteria to right. have a dumpster.
Right. Right. Yeah. But, you know, I maybe read into the neighborhood dumpster program. Because I know that this is something that was plugged in, like, neighborhood associations, and I know that the funding that used to be present for, I guess they called it neighborhood association mini.
There used to be a separate pot for neighborhood associations to apply for dumpsters. We kind of combine that. And
got it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I like combining that. How do you reach out to the other neighborhoods that don't have formalized?
Right now it's been like staff identified needs, and so that's how we've contacted neighborhoods and done dumpsters, and then neighborhoods can also reach out and ask for them.
Yeah, and they learn about it through flyers or postcards. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. And the only other thing I'll note under there that council can expect is a report probably in January or February about our kind of pilot property scoring condition project that Neighborhood Services has done this past fall.
I'm going to ask a question to you and council as well, but if there is a desire for more code enforcement, is that going to kind of run parallel to kind of parameters set for the housing trust fund? Would you offer, if there's more of a stick, especially on the homeowner side, because we're talking rentals, but there's a lot of home owner occupied that fall into disrepair because of deferred maintenance.
Yes.
And so if there's going to be a desire to push more people through a code enforcement, is there also going to be parameters set on the housing trust fund side to offer the carrot to go along with the stick?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And that actually goes into another one of these items here, which is the Replicate the Home Rehab and Energy Efficiency Program. And that was really a recommendation for other communities to replicate the city's home rehab program. But I would really like to see ways that our home rehab program can better coordinate with properties that are being identified for code enforcement issues to be able to facilitate those repairs when it is an issue of not being able to financially bring the house into compliance. And I think the housing trust fund could also be used to, because I think the problem with our home repair program, just frankly, is that it's funded with HUD funding, and it sometimes creates more hurdles than some people are able or willing to jump through to get to the point that they're able to be financed for the repairs. And so to the extent that we can make that more flexible with the housing trust fund, I think that'd be great.
Can I do a quick time check? You mentioned that you guys are approving your budget this afternoon. Okay, I wanted to make sure. And I was just thinking about, for some of these things that we have on the list, obviously some of them, it's not us, you know, for part of
right.
those.
Mm-hmm.
Is the idea also for us to identify on some of these, like, you know, are we thinking then for, like, this next one right there where it's, like, participate in the MHDC. Is this the idea as to, is we're going to CMCA or to, you know what I mean? Like, do we initiate that sort of conversation with them, or do we just send them an email and be like, hey, this is a recommendation, Darren, go forth and do? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, at least I know that some of these organizations have read this and have thoughts on whether or not they could implement these, but I think it would also be a good thing for the city and the county to reach out to those organizations that they think could, you know, fulfill some of these responsible stakeholder roles and at least let them know that they could be a part of accomplishing these goals.
Okay.
And what we can do to you know, provide them assistance or resources to do it.
Well, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure where CMCA is on this. And I've heard from someone who is there that that they probably wouldn't do this, and it's largely because of the administrative requirements of it. I tried to speak convincingly. Say, can you wrap that into the grant application? Which I assume can to some degree. That's their determination. But it could be that someone else might be able to make application for this grant as well. And identifying who that is, I'm not sure how to go about that. but depending on one particular agency or group to do it, might not. We might need to think a little more broadly about that.
A lot as we. Is there anything else in the preservation recommendations that anybody wants to discuss?
No, I think it's good. I'm kind of taking notes. Like some of our things are follow-ups. Like on this one is maybe the staff think about what is the scope of a housing inventory project look like. Is it the sort of thing that a capacity that a graduate student intern could help with or what?
I think that first phase, that ended up being a great project.
So I think thinking that through, that's kind of my takeaway from that one.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
What's the status of the central area overlay? I know that we kind of sent that back for...
Hey, Tim, I'm going to call on you real quick for that. The status of the central overlay.
Yeah, we've got that on pause right now. We've had a couple meetings with the consultant, and we're really trying to get them to a place where they approach that a little different. I need to bug them about getting back to us now with some new information. Sorry I haven't done that to date, but that's where it's at. What I'm speaking of here is they had really produced for the public some things that I call models of change. If you studied those drawings of transformation of neighborhoods, and I think it's all a little bit much for folks because they're looking at their neighborhoods.
That's an understatement, Tim.
Really,
I said that's an understatement.
Yeah, so what I'm getting at here on the topic of preservation is that as we add density, we want to make sure that that doesn't result in displacement, because a lot of times the immediate effect of adding density is that you removed a more affordable single unit and replaced it with four that are slightly more expensive. And in the long run, there can be benefits to that. But we want to make sure that we're preserving the affordable housing that already exists when it's in a condition that can be preserved. And I'm looking at the overlay to use some of those preservation-minded policies in a judicial way. I think given that that's in process and there's a desire to have preservation in there, we can address that in a way that informs affordable housing and maintains affordable housing.
Okay, so moving on to both the empowerment and the sustainability recommendations, a lot of the responsible stakeholders in both of these categories are outside of the city and county. So I guess my thought here would be to focus on those that do involve the city and county. You know, there's some, I think, like the expand homeowner education and financial literacy classes and invest in skilled labor training. To the extent that those are, you know, all the responsible stakeholders are outside of these two entities, also keeping in mind that both of these entities fund a lot of those nonprofits that do this work, and that funding's important to accomplish these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this is one of the questions that I have about that. There are some, these programs already exist. Mm-hmm. Part of my question is how much more capacity do we need in the community for this purpose? And I think hearing from those who are already doing the work might be helpful in this way. So if, for instance, they have room for 10 in a particular class that lasts for 5 weeks or whatever, and they have 15 applications, or they have seven, you know, that would tell us something about where we are in terms of capacity. I think that, you know, and you also, their capacity we need to keep in mind, too. If there's a need for more, we can't just expect those who are already doing it to do more.
Yeah.
So it may be some finding someone else. But in the same way that we are talking about incentivizing developers, we're also going to have to support those who are going to do this kind of work as well if we're looking to expand it.
Well, I think a part of that too is also what role can we play in helping educate about the opportunities of these programs and things? Just because, do we still teach homeworks, Becky or Jennifer? I don't know if we still teach the homeowner education as a requirement if you get any of our funds as a new first-time homebuyer. Do we still do that education?
Becky does that to support the homebuyer education classes.
Yeah.
Love Columbia.
Okay. Yeah. Just thinking about, you know what I mean, like helping get more people involved in those. Yeah.
So I think the challenge is expanding something when we don't have expanded inventory.
Yeah. I think that's what Love Columbia would
that's true.
So, yeah. So it's one thing to, and so I think the education is always fantastic. Then the opportunity following that education is minimal. Because we don't have the inventory.
Financial literacy may be the more important.
I was thinking more towards renters who are, you know, like how do you then, the maintenance of homes too could help you if you're also renting.
Right. There is one piece here that I guess my finance background, it gives me some anxiety when I read it. When I see established rent-to-own programs, I admittedly get a pretty kind of stressed when I read that. So I'm not sure where that's coming from.
I don't know a whole lot about the rent-to-own programs, and I frankly haven't looked into it a whole lot because I don't think it's something that the city would be taking an active
I would role. Highly discourage that route.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I would just encourage if we could even just remove it from this. I don't think
why
that's...
That?
Rent-to-own is such a terrible program. It's very, why? Very seldom do they ever close, for one. And it, very seldom do they ever close. Now, having an option to buy, that's a completely different type of scenario. But really often, all it does is keep people who cannot afford something in a poverty cycle. They very seldom ever, like, the best thing is just to be able to purchase clean, not have to get caught up in a rent-to-own type of mortgage lend. It's just, they're messy. And they're very highly discouraged, just to put it simply.
Usually you're going to end up paying more for the home than you would otherwise, right?
Yeah.
So this one is really there for housing developers and mortgage lenders. I don't know that, I agree, I don't know how the city or the county would be in, and there are so many other things on our plates, I don't know that this is something we'd want to invest a whole lot of time and effort in encouraging even. But if they choose to do it, that's up to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an important point to keep in mind as we like look at all these. This is just the reflection of what the recommendations from the housing study done by this consultant are. And that, you know, Nick said yesterday at the Affordable Housing Coalition that the housing study is a tool for us, right? We don't have to implement all of the recommendations that we can, but just to be able to go through them and I think talk about them like this is important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
I think anything under this one. The Como Transit study is wrapping up. DeCarla may know a little bit more about that than I do currently, but I know that we should be expecting something in the fairly near future regarding the report and recommendations from the transit study.
Yeah, because Shane just sent something out to the council just to make sure that he had
all
down exactly
questions.
What questions right. they want him to investigate. And so the next step is to bring back a report from the study to say what are some of the next steps we can kind of look at.
Can I just ask about invest in skilled labor training?
Yeah.
We didn't really talk about that. We have a number of people who are doing this as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have the same question about this as I do in terms of the homeownership classes is what's the necessary, what do we need? I know this is a big deal. I talk to people who are in building and they, one of their biggest issues is having people who can do the work. That's going to be an ongoing issue, and I know we're trying to address it this way. Do we need to do any more here, or are we doing what we need to do with labor training?
I think that's a question that we need to kind of talk to some of the providers that are providing that service. You know, talk to JobPoint, see if they're or those organizations, see what are their additional needs. Some of it's funding. You know, mm-hmm. if you're going to do an initial programming, it's how do you do that? I know Interaction is trying to do a forklift program. They can't find a site. And so it's
Interaction.
Interaction, yeah. So it's those conversations of trying to figure out how can we help them get to that next step. Mm-hmm.
And JobPoint has some similar challenges. But it's all of those places that are teaching. You know, I think Stevens College has a pretty robust program with some resources that others might not have. But the other piece of this is, to my mind, I have some friends in the building business who are more open to having folks with a criminal record, mm-hmm. And they've found those folks by and large to be great great workers. But having more people that are willing to hire folks with that kind of background, there are more and more of those folks in our community, and giving having them get a skill that will help pay for their needs, then that helps everybody. So I think that's something that encouraging the building community to make those hiring decisions.
So, maybe the role that we play is in the convening of those different groups to see where those gaps are. And yep. I think of Ready and the Chamber are kind of currently doing this with some of their, the Chamber's, the Show Me Career, and then also the other projects that we just gave ARPA funding for. And so it might just be kind of like, and it doesn't even need to be like we all get around. It could even just be a survey of kind of like what is it that you're looking for? So if it's like Into Action and Dan's looking for a site for the, you know what I mean? Like then helping connect those resources, that might be the role that we play because they're the ones actually doing it. But what could we play as far as like seeing where those gaps are?
Just to add to what you're saying, mm-hmm. the Upward Mobility Jobs Workforce Group being led by right now Lisa Drixel-Hoxby is working on that, and some of the things that are coming out of there are we have the Department of Corrections, we had Ready, and we have the new individual who's from the Chamber attending those meetings, as well as the high school person who's talking about jobs and hooking people up to jobs. So they're having three work groups that are going to be really diving into this. So just know
look at this magic. It just happens. It just set a gap.
Yeah. So awesome. Please know that the justice involved folks, that is a big issue, and getting those folks some good jobs.
Yeah.
So I know the Second Chance Leasing Group also from mm-hmm. Upward Mobility is looking at that from a housing standpoint.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The one that Shauna mm-hmm. got started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How are the recommendations from those groups passed to legislative bodies?
Right now, it's more of an internal work group document. I think we have some of those documents up on our website. We have an Upward Mobility website that's linked to the Community Services Department.
And you just had your annual report.
Yeah, we just
went
had
out.
Our annual report. We put one out once a year. So those are some things. I mean, you're welcome to reach out to me, and I can kind of share if anybody's interested. And we're trying to make those a little more streamlined, so you can see the strategic actions and who's working on what. I know we're doing that with all of our work groups right now. And it's evolving. You want the same people to come to the table all the time, and then you have people that don't come, and then they do come, and then you have to so community work is fun. So.
I think the other thing this all touches on in the empowerment recommendations are using the existing resources effectively, right? So
right.
We have a lot of these organizations that are doing the work. How do we make sure that we're supporting them and that we're all talking together?
Yeah.
We've got about 15 minutes.
I know.
So
get
do
to the
we,
land
do we want
bank.
To move on to the final one of sustainability?
Yes, please.
Okay. I think...
The land bank, just...
Let's talk about, so I think this is something that I would like to move forward with looking at from a city perspective. The term here is short-term, so 0 to 2 years. To be honest, I think to actually have a land bank created, I mean, it requires a board. There's a land bank bill for background for anyone that's not familiar with it. House Bill 2062 was passed by the legislature this past session. It allows any municipality with greater than 1,500 people to create a land bank. A land bank essentially acts as a repository for properties that are tax delinquent or abandoned, and it allows them to be redeveloped with clear title in kind of a more efficient way than what the current system allows for.
it's a, we don't have to, it's a nice tool. We don't have to use it for, you know, any number of properties. You can use it for, you can choose to use it as you want to use it. But I think it would be a really good tool for the city to have for those properties that seem to just kind of be like those zombie properties, right, that are out there that are tax delinquent, that may take a lot of resources from an individual to be able to purchase a property, foreclose, get clear title, and redevelop it for some, you know, meaningful use.
I recently heard about a city who uses this process. Now, whether they have a land bank or not, I'm not sure, but they take city properties that they own and they issue RFPs for their use.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have that kind of, if we have a bank or whatever form it takes,
mm-hmm.
the idea of issuing RFPs was stimulating to me, the idea that it puts that out there for others to have their ideas mm-hmm. about it and to bring them to the table in ways that the city alone, the county alone, are not going to be able to.
Much more transparent.
Yeah, and you put it into the development community and say, hey, what can you do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think so this, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to disclaimer, I'd be remiss if I didn't say in front of everyone, I know I've had this conversation with Carlin, with Barbara, and with Becky as well, but for everyone's, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that I would encourage you to have conversations with the collector, Boone County Collector,
yes.
An independently elected official, one of our colleagues who has reservations about land banking, or just a lot of questions exist. I would not contact the collector until about mid-January at this point.
Is why parking's so bad right now downtown? Everyone's visiting him.
But we've told him that if and when this conversation starts up with any of our municipal partners, that we would encourage them to reach out to him directly to talk about this as well.
So that's why I think, I mean, I don't think it's something we can jump right into, right? I think all those conversations mm-hmm. have to happen. And I would be very curious to hear what his hesitation is.
But it may not be required to do what we want to do.
Right, and I think there's other mechanisms to get there, and I think for land that, you know, obviously the city already owns, you could do that process, right?
But you might want a mechanism where property could be donated, for instance. And,
mm-hmm.
kind of
and I'm not saying that the collector can't be brought along on this. I just want to say that
it's a conversation.
That's right. Yeah. I've done my
thing. Right. No, absolutely. And I think just from a policy perspective, it's a really useful tool for cities that are dealing with a lot of vacancy, which luckily Columbia kind of has the opposite problem. That's not one of our big problems, but to the extent it could be something that is useful, it's worth looking into.
Well, and I think, from my understanding, part of the conversation around this one is not just around those, it's also about how many properties in our community are there kind of messy titles with?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And especially for homeowners who are there, especially the inherited ones, right? Mm-hmm. It's more of like, what can we do to help support getting the person who is the homeowner, getting that tech clear so that they're the historical, whatever has happened in the past, you know, how do we help them through that process? So it's not necessarily working through Brian, you know, through the chat, it's more of like, what can we do to help facilitate the legal needs, whatever it is that they need to,
I think having conversations with our legal services and what they already provide, what additional resources they might need to provide more of that assistance would be worthwhile.
I think the transparency of it is really important because I might be wrong about this, but I think the city of St. Louis has participated in programs similar to this, as well as some areas in the Metro East where it maybe wasn't as transparent, and there were some questions about that. And I don't know, to Carlin, if you've had experience or education in some other cities where you can give a cautionary tale.
Well, it's not necessarily a cautionary tale. So I was in St. Louis County, and so didn't have the ability that St. Louis City had, but we had quite a few homes that people walked away from. And so you found yourself with a lot of vacant properties that were becoming impediments to growth in your community. And so having clear title would allow us to move those whole homes along. And so from the city standpoint, what we were doing is we were actually paying attorneys to clear the legal title and going through that process, which takes a lot longer and it's a lot more difficult. And so the beauty of this process could be that it allows you to clear those titles in a way that is more efficient and allows you to move that property from a status of being that eyesore in your neighborhood to actually being somewhere where someone can call a home. And so it's that process. I think with St. Louis City, it was more of some of the things that is St. Louis City.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a reason to move.
Thanks. Yeah, but it is. I mean, it's all about process, right? And that you're getting the process that you do. And,
yep. Yeah. Thank you.
So I know there's other hands that have hands. I love the last two are obviously, I think, just basic best recommendations in general, cost-benefit analysis regulations, as well as leveraging the partnerships. So we have some kind of things for next steps for this, and I guess I'd just kind of be interested in what we think those are and about whether or not another, I assume staff will be kind of getting together on some of these, but then what our next steps are as far as our collaboration. A lot of the takeaways I know are just the city will be looking at you, right, because it's not county or just the county, but just kind of what you all are thinking and going forward, and then also just really appreciative of all the work that's gone into this and then the momentum that I'm seeing going forward. Like, I think that's exciting. Just like how Joanne started us off by talking about it's exciting. Yeah.
What do you all feel would be helpful as far as, I mean, I think these conversations are really helpful. Mm-hmm. I know that I've gotten a lot more clarity as far as next steps for me and my staff. Do you all think having another joint meeting at some designated time in the future, as far as a general time frame? And then what needs to happen, I think, between now and then, collectively, to be able to bring to the table?
I think from my perspective, for some of the things that we know that we're doing, like, for instance, you know, if we start this project with, like, housing inventory or the preservation inventory or some of the reviews of different things, we have, like, an update to give. Mm-hmm. That would be kind of, like, the thing that pulls the lever on getting us all back together. Or just something to share of information, or if there's a joint decision that needs to go, I think would be useful. But my assumption is that now it's kind of like staff are going to be getting together and coming back to council if resources are needed or changes in ordinances or wanting to know the direction to go. I assume that's at a organizational level. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
An update from the upward mobility housing work group. I mean, I think that's because there are so many people that are involved, so many organizations that are involved in that, and, you know, Joanne could probably articulate better who's not at the table and needs to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are people who are wanting to become involved, and the question is just how.
Wow.
So, you know, for instance, in the Affordable Housing Coalition, part of what we are looking at and what we're wanting to look at are policy and those kinds of things. And I think it's about having the opportunity to review those kinds of issues and then provide some feedback and some input into it. Goes back to a question I had, is really who picks this up and goes forward. And this may very well look different in the county than it does in the city, because we're structured differently. But, you know, we'll be looking to staff to really tell us where we went. I think the matrix is really helpful. Again, it's a tool, but it's a tool within a tool, and it says you can work on this and this and this. Most of our conversation today was around policy, and that, I think, is the one thing that probably is the hottest part of all of this too. So, and I think the impediments to what we're wanting to do may be couched there more than in these other things. So in terms of effort, that's where I'd like to see that. And I was caught by what you said about a process flow chart. I suppose I would love to see that, you know, the development of a flow chart in policy development in particular, but in some of these others. So here's what we want to see happen. Here are some steps along the way that get us there. Mm-hmm. And then who are the stakeholders that need to be brought in along the way in having that conversation? Mm-hmm. So that's going to include developers, builders, realtors. It's going to be people who are in need of housing too, and hearing from people in the community what their actual needs are. So that's kind of what I'm looking for.
What about a quarterly meeting? What about if we look at March, kind of around this time in March, March 19th, 20th, somewhere around there for an hour lunch meeting, hour and a half, and then we can hear from staff. We can kind of get an update on from staff and from council commission, I guess, on kind of the progress in certain areas? Because it sounds like P&Z from the city perspective may have some stuff to you guys early.
Within the next 3 months, yeah, sounds months. Like.
And then we can kind of.
Do the 14th March.
You guys out there?
We're looking at it.
Okay.
I mean, just as a, it's yeah. a Friday.
I mean, we can
Friday.
Even do that following
yeah.
week.
It's a Friday.
We can even do later, yeah.
We'll think about spring break.
Next week is a problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
The next week is a problem.
Gotcha.
But yeah, something quarterly. Just setting that kind of cadence
yeah, right. Right.
of quarterly
right.
is
yeah.
helpful.
Yeah.
But yeah, something like that. Because then that way, then the idea is that we've also probably had a council staff meeting about this in the interim between that, gotten some updates, and then, yeah,
yeah.
things have
yeah.
come forward.
A lunch yeah. date on Friday, March
14th.
Lunch yeah. date. You're talking about 11 to 1 again? The lunch date extended lunch?
Are you
what?
Hosting this time?
Oh, we can. Well, we that's to be determined.
Taco Barn.
We will determine
Taco
where we're
Barn.
Be.
Taco Barn.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
We'll get Brianna to do that.
Yeah.
She does that really well.
She does.
I like that. Yeah.
I also think it would be helpful to have, like, I just saw this letter, like, it came this morning, so, you know, it's so helpful, and then it's like,
There's some overlap in what we talked
about.
Absolutely.
There's
new things.
There
yeah.
is.
But wasn't it, I mean, it's great that they gave it. It would have been nice earlier, but.
Right.
But thank you, but.
So it'd be helpful to have the dots connect
mm-hmm.
with, like, because I know that there's been a lot of input from a lot of different
yeah.
groups for this, so.
Yeah.
To have the dots connect with, you know, what
well,
we're doing.
Who's in it, the core on something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody
right.
that says yes.
Yeah. I have one. Earlier we were talking about the impact of including Ashland, Centralia, Hallsville. Do you want to see about inviting them to the meeting or get their input via the county?
That's a good idea.
How do we want to address it?
That's a good idea.
Or do
I would look to you all.
Yeah,
and
we can
yeah.
certainly, as we set up a next meeting and quarterly meetings move forward, we'll certainly
yeah.
invite our municipal partners.
That's
perhaps
a really good
Regional
idea.
Sewer District as well.
Yep.
Mm. Yeah, sewer's a big deal. You know, it's been brought up before. Infrastructure in general, and that is a different challenge in the outer parts of the county than
that's,
it is for the city.
That's what drives it.
Yeah.
Or it should. You know, otherwise you end up in trouble.
Yeah. I wonder, though, whether it, I feel like this is pretty heavy towards the city of Columbia and then some county. Would you all want to have a different meeting where you have the different municipalities and just have a representative from Columbia versus quite such a large Columbia contingent?
We can invite them.
Yeah.
And just see what they
yeah.
say. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so it's now 1 o'clock, and I know you all need to get to your commission meeting to vote on a budget, which I'm sure that your staff at the table appreciates. I want to thank everybody and all of the staff here, all of our amazing elected officials, local, and everyone else in the room, because it's a really important issue. So thank you for continuing and keeping the momentum going. I'll go ahead and adjourn us.